Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. Today I'm your host, Carl Nellis, and we are talking with Liam Cole Young. Dr. Young teaches in the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario. We're talking about his new book, List Cultures, Knowledge and Poetics from Mesopotamia to BuzzFeed, out from Amsterdam University Press and here in the U.S., University of Chicago Press. Liam, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk with you about this complex, interesting, detailed, very scholarly book, in part because it touches on so many relevant and interesting things and challenges, will certainly challenge my thinking, and I think will challenge in really productive ways readers who are interested in any of the fields that you engage. Could we start with a little bit about who you are? What your training is, what your background is, and how that brought you to List Cultures.
Sure. Yeah. I did PhD in media studies at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, Canada. I think the book emerges very clearly from that discipline. And the reason that I sort of ended up in media studies and media theory was it provided a sort of welcome home for inviting in lots of different interests and disciplines and literatures that I had been, you know, kind of working in throughout my undergraduate career and into grad school and things like that. So, originally I started in history and international relations way back when, sort of undergraduate days, and then switched gears a little bit as I moved into grad school and started thinking about popular culture and cultural studies, cultural history, those types of things. And what I sort of found as I moved through those disciplines and that sort of training was that the sort of technical aspects of culture and the kind of infrastructural aspects of culture were shifting really quite rapidly all around us. And so media studies gave me a place in which to think through those kind of intersections between a technology, politics, and cultural activity.
Right.
So, you know, the book is the kind of extension of those, you know, those early days. And I kind of landed on this particular object that I found to be really productive to invite them all in. And so I started working on it back then and have been working on it ever since.
So how would you describe your book? Maybe what's the 30-second pitch of your book, maybe that you gave to the publisher when you were looking for someone to work with you on getting this out?
Well, I half seriously pitch it to people as it's a book that argues for the list as the origin of culture, which is an aphorism that I picked up from Umberto Eco, who was, you know, great for such things. But the sort of brief pitch is that there is this sort of layer of activity, right? There are these forms through which culture circulates that we tend not to pay attention to, that we tend not to notice, that seem to kind of fade into the background and we take them for granted. And yet they are so crucial to the way that we understand ourselves and our place in the world. And so what the book is trying to do, develop some tools for thinking through some of the ways that listing techniques have been used throughout history and how they are a site of immense kind of power and conflict.
So one of the things that you make clear in the introduction is that in approaching the list, you take what you call the media materialist approach, and that it's by looking at lists in this particular way that you come to the understanding that you've just laid out for us. What is media materialism, and how is it important to grappling with the questions that you're asking here?
Well, media materialism is this term that some of us have started to use to signify a general kind of attentiveness to the kind of material instantiations of cultural technologies. So media materialism is attentive to, you know, the kind of the surfaces upon which we make inscriptions, whether that's paper or chalk or silicon, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of really being alive to the differences between media platforms, media surfaces, and things like that. Because the argument that a lot of scholars working in this tradition make, that it's there that these kind of crucial distinctions and these crucial sort of activities are occurring, that serve to kind of organize or shape our broader senses of space and time. And so I see media materialism as part of this lineage of studying sort of material culture, right? So we have historical materialism, we have cultural materialism, right? And these are disciplines that are trying to kind of incorporate and understand the kind of material instantiations of things like, you know, ideology, and forces and relations of production. And in the same way, media materialism is trying to kind of integrate those material aspects of media devices and technologies into the conversation so that we're not just thinking about how we use any medium, whether it's paper or television or a smartphone, but what are the kind of actual parameters of that device, and how does the structure of the device kind of impose certain forms and modes of use upon the user?
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about a device imposing forms of use on the user, there's a point in the book where you discuss why your approach can't simply just be dismissed as technological determinism. Would this be a good time for you to kind of poke at that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, technological determinism is this term that gets thrown around fair amount.
I think less so
today. We're starting to see a shift in that, in the use of that term. But, you know, for many years, it was used to signal, as a kind of pejorative, to signal a kind of scholarship that was accused of denying the sort of agency of human beings, right? As sort of masters of our domain, masters of our worlds. So scholarship that was accused of technological determinism was suggested to be attaching agency to technologies and to media forms as the kind of drivers of history. But what that critique sort of misses, I think, is that surely technology determines something, right? Because not all technologies are equal, right? Not all technologies function in the same kind of way. And so each individual device, platform, format, standard, you know, has certain kind of limits to it, has a certain kind of parameter. It sets the rules of the game in a certain kind of way, right? Which will structure how that object can be used or the way that that object is taken up in the world, right? So, you know, the telephone is a kind of object that has material properties that determine in a certain way how we can use it and what it can be used for, right? So it's very much about the voice and the mouth and the ear and the hand, right? Those are the sensory aspects of the telephone. And so what critiques of technological determinism ignore is the fact that that device determines the fact that someone who's hard of hearing is excluded from the discourse community of telephone conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of corrective that a lot of, you know, scholars working in this kind of broad umbrella category of media materialism are pushing back against, is to say, like, you know, to acknowledge these structural boundaries or limitations is not to deny agency to humans or to be anti-human. It's just to be honest about the ways that we are constantly kind of inframed by devices and networks and and processes.
So let's jump into how the list functions as a technical device.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, how you run it through history. Let's start with Mesopotamia, where you begin with the history of the list and how it enters into human relations.
So one of the things that was really fun about the project and surprising in the best possible way was that, you know, when I first started thinking about this, thinking about lists, it was very contemporary, right? It was very much about sort of promotional culture, digital culture, the way that people were using lists online, right? So the sort of Facebook 25 things craze, you know, all of these like best of all time collections, Pitchfork's like top 100 singles of each year or whatever. And so I was like really interested in this sort of cultural activity that was happening around the list. And so once I sort of grasped onto this object, I started to think about, okay, well, you know, what else has been written about this? How have other people thought about this? And there was a kind of surprising lack of scholarship on the object. And so that, you know, is the best possible result, right? You identify that there's a great gap and a great opportunity here. And so, but some of what I could find came from anthropology and ancient history and histories of writing. And I was really surprised and excited to discover that listing, you know, is generally accepted to be the earliest form of writing, at least the earliest surviving form of writing, right? So we tend to think, you know, we tend to assume certain things about writing in our sort of general day-to-day cultural lives, right? We think of writing as stories, as narratives. You know, maybe we think about writing as scholarship or kind of scientific reports, these types of things. But actually, the vast majority of writing that we do and have always done is administrative, right? It's about bookkeeping. It's about inventorying. It's about memos, you know, as great scholars like John Guillory and Joanne Yates have taught us. And so it has always been thus, right? And so when you sort of survey the emergence of writing, you start to see that it actually wasn't the epics of literature and narrative that emerged first, but it was grain inventories and receipts and things like this, right? And so so that's kind of the Mesopotamia in the subtitle is to show, right, this not only this huge broad history of lists, which allows me to borrow Eco's aphorism about lists inventing culture, but also to kind of foreground for us that there are these forms of writing that have structured cultural activity and human activity for millennia that we should probably pay a little bit more attention to.
I don't want to leave behind something that you just said because it runs through the argument of your book, and it's almost, and you can correct me if I misread this, but I see a conflict or an opposition between the list and the way that the kinds of uses that lists can be put to and the kinds of thinking that they allow and narrative. Can you talk a little bit about list versus narrative, or listing versus, in some cases, you talk about the linearity of narrative? So how was it you came to see this kind of opposition between lists and linearity?
Well, lists are, they're a different kind of mode of organizing information, right? So part of what media theory and information theory allows us to think about is in this kind of meta way about, you know, stories or any kind of cultural kind of expression as, you know, organizations of data points or organizations of information, right? So when you want to write a book, you want to tell a story, you organize the events in a certain kind of way. And narratives are this kind of cultural form that have a lot of connective tissue between the ideas, right? They have certain kinds of structures, right? So there is a kind of, you know, conventional narrative has a kind of beginning, middle, and end. The relations between those different points or those different items within a kind of narrative structure is clearly defined in this kind of generic way, according to its genre, right? But the list is a little bit different, right? The list is an organization of data that is about accumulation, right? Aggregation. Mm-hmm. And there are different ways that one can carve pathways through a list as a gathering of items that are different than the way that one sort of carves a path through a narrative structure. So it's not that I want to set up a grand opposition between these two, but just to sort of isolate lists as, you know, a different kind of structure for the organization of information that allows us to do different kinds of things. So it's about drawing things together. It's about organization. It's about administration. It's about kind of the minutiae of day-to-day life in a way that narratives are about stories and, you know, histories and mythologies and these kinds of things.
Later in our conversation, I want to come back to the idea of aggregation because you do some really interesting things with aggregation and disaggregation in the way that, for instance, the BuzzFeed listicle functions. That comes toward the end of your book, where you go after chapter one and kind of the history and looking at the emergence of writing. You do come to the present. You go to the pop chart.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about data and knowledge and the creation of a cultural field with the way that pop charts function.
Mm-hmm. I talked earlier about the kind of origins of the project, laying in sort of more contemporary settings, and popular music was, I think, the field that was the crucial one for my thinking about this, because it was where I first started to notice there seemed to me at the time to be no cultural field that was more amenable to listing activities and for which the list was more important, right, to the way that knowledge and kind of cultural activity circulated within the field, right? So top 40 charts, sales charts are these structures of order used within the industry to organize information, to communicate information between, producers and consumers, to do all of these things. So lists do a lot in popular music. Certainly from the industrial side of things. And then, from the fan side of things, too, it seems very much part of musical fandom to organize your collection, alphabetize it, have your list of top 10, top 10 Paul McCartney songs versus top 10 John Lennon songs. It's like it's important to the way that people communicate their taste and their judgments. Yes. And these types of things. And so that was where I kind of started to take some of these tools from media studies and information studies and to try to kind of apply them to this object, right? To this field of cultural activity. And so I really like the phrase unblackboxing, which I borrowed from science and technology studies, Bruno Latour and other thinkers in that field, opening up the black box, which is, the thing that we take for granted and haven't really put under the analytic or under our analytic eye in this kind of way before, and trying to take it apart and see how it works and how it's made and then how it goes out in the world and the differences that it makes. And so once you start to do that to popular music lists, you get a feel for the way that these things carve out genres, they carve out taste communities, they carve out canons by which the field kind of understands itself, both in terms of producers and consumers. So that is kind of a major part of that segment of the argument. And then the other side of it is that, the kind of related side is that a lot of the concepts and the categories and things that we use to understand and talk about popular music, right, emerged first on the charts. So the category of popular derived kind of directly from these lists of popular songs heard in vaudeville last week and these kinds of things, right? And so before popular was ever identified as like a market niche or a genre, which is the way we kind of understand that term now, it was used as this kind of administrative term by, sheet music producers and earlier radio programmers and some of the people from important to the early history of American popular music.
Over the next two chapters, you really dive into the way that lists function in you draw a little on Foucault, and you talk about governmentality. And the way that lists function in organizing and structuring political choices and the rise of statistics. But you go back to the invention of double entry bookkeeping. So let's jump there. And can you talk about lists and the state and the fact and how double entry bookkeeping plays into your argument?
Yeah, well, that section of the book arises from thinking a little bit more fulsomely about how lists are used to administer, right? So once I kind of understood this is a form that is deployed in order to order, all of a sudden, that kind of crystallizes out into a whole bunch of different problematics, right? A whole bunch of different ways of trying to understand the role of these sort of hidden administrative or infrastructural forms and techniques. So, thinking about double entry bookkeeping, Mary Poovey eminent sort of history of science scholar, wrote this great book a number of years ago where she traces the origins of the sort of category of the fact, right? Nature of facticity and the kind of empirical knowledge that is so crucial to the history of Western science and modern kind of science. And so part of her argument is that techniques of double entry bookkeeping in sort of 14th, 15th century Italian commerce are part of this story, right? Because it was on, here on paper where a whole host of kind of concepts that lead us toward the emergence of something like the concept of the fact arise, one of which is sort of transparency, right? So the books are about laying out the inventory of capital or of goods that are being exchanged, right? In a way that is transparent and open and can be recreated and recalled. So this is part of it. It's also about kind of capturing these processes that unfold through time and spatializing them into a formal structure on paper and creating this kind of living archive of what has happened. My contribution to that train of thinking is to kind of bring this analysis of the format, right? Because a double entry, the double entry books are a series of kind of interoperable lists, right? This list structure is here at this moment that we can point to as a generative one, right? In which new conceptions of transparency and authenticity and even one's sort of like almost purity before God is displayed, right? There's this kind of religious, these are kind of overcoded by the religious discourse of the time, right? To be conscientious, to keep conscientiously one's books was to be a good subject of God and to live a godly kind of life. And so, you know, as I'm following this form through history, this seemed to me to be a very kind of crucial and important moment in which we see this formal structure functioning in this kind of way. And so I tried to unpack that a little bit and then expand out from there and show that, you know, once the concept of the fact arises, you know, from these double entry lists, that concept goes out in the world and does all kinds of work, right? It is a kind of anchor point upon which a whole epistemology kind of arises, right? So statistics and calculation and all of these very familiar ways of knowing, familiar to us now as sort of modern people, ways of knowing are built upon these basic units such as the concept of the fact. And so introducing a kind of formal analysis of how that happens, you know, on paper before somebody names it as something is part of my kind of contribution to that literature, because we tend to think, we think about intellectual history or social history, political history, we tend to think about it as histories of ideas or histories of great people or great events. And in actuality, what the historical record shows us is that history is about, you know, everyday kind of techniques of administration and you know, exchange and commerce and all of these things. And so it's not just that somebody has the idea, the fact, right? That concept emerges out of these ways of doing and ways of knowing that are kind of implicit. So that's kind of the entry point into that section of the book.
And you mentioned calculation, but a couple of other terms that become important going forward in your argument are compression and circulation. And that does pull us into the next chapter as well. But maybe can you talk about the three together, calculation, compression, and circulation, how the list functions for those three processes?
I kind of identified those three as a useful heuristic through which to understand some of these forces and processes of modernity in which I started to see the list as being particularly important, right? So what I'm doing in this, well, throughout the book, but it, particularly in this section, is sort of tracing the list through the world, right? Trying to see what it is that it does. And what lists do is that they facilitate certain kinds of activities, right? So the act of administration, of kind of drawing things together that a list allows us to do, is done for with certain ends in mind, right? So calculation, compression, circulation are three such things. So Calculation is a kind of way of knowing that is about moving things around. Probabilities, it kind of opens up in the modern period. I think the literature shows us, right, the historical record shows us, is that this like way of looking at the world opens up, that is about formalizing operations with certain ends kind of in mind, right? So calculation is about, you know, efficiency. It's about moving stuff around in as short amount of time as possible, right? So compression is part of this, right? The three are, the reason it's kind of hard to talk about them individually is because I view them as kind of this nest of related concepts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So calculation, compression, circulation are all about, you know, these kinds of new enterprises and these new expressions of culture and politics and commerce that arise, I think, in the modern period. And what we see is that the things that are listed, you know, vary. So sometimes we see lists of things. Sometimes we see lists of people. Sometimes we see lists of times or of events or of inventories, right? And so in each case, it seemed to me that we can see that this is an object that's sort of facilitating the manipulation or the kind of movement or the molding of whatever material is listed according mm-hmm. to the ends that the lister has in mind. And that's where it kind of brought me into some strange kind of resonances between seemingly very divergent fields of culture and history, you know, popular music history and this kind of longer histories of statecraft, and, you know, into, you know, the sort of emergence of 20th century fascism and the Nazi census.
Well, and you talk about the way that lists are used in the Nazi census to make up a person.
Mm-hmm. Well, any list is about drawing a border. It's an act of immense power, right? It's an act of pulling together certain things or certain people, drawing a border around them, and keeping others out, and perhaps attaching a title to that collection of people, right? And so when we think about the history of the Third Reich and the history of Nazism, this is a major plank through which that vision of the world was attempted to be forged, right? Through mm-hmm. Categorization, striking these, what Foucault calls caesuras between categories of people, right? Between groups of people. And so the state comes to see individuals according to the way that they are categorized. And the places in which they are categorized are not just in people's minds or people's assumptions or in kind of ideological positions, but are actually on paper, right? Are actually
right.
on
right.
population registries and passenger manifest lists and these kinds of banal, seemingly unimportant material forms.
You know, you discussed these uses of lists as an aspect of modernity, and there's an interesting section here where you discuss various terms for naming this modern orientation, and you discuss whether it could be called administrative or bureaucratic or informational, and you choose logistical. Can you talk about why a logistical orientation or a logistical modernity is the right way or was a useful way for you to talk about the kinds of relationships that are put in place with listing in what we consider modernity?
I like the term logistics. It's helpful to me because it captures movement and it's temporal. Part of the history of modernity is that it is a history of building, right? Of mm-hmm. reshaping the earth in all of these quite sort of catastrophic mega ways, right? The history of modern infrastructure teaches us this, and modern systems of governance and statecraft and all of these things is kind of like this story of sort of increasing the scale of this this reshaping. Right, reshaping mm-hmm. the world mm-hmm. in certain ways. And so trying to contribute to a history of modernity is to understand the different techniques or strategies or projects of this kind of reshaping of the world, right? That's what's kind of captured for me in the term logistics, right? So it's mm-hmm. it goes beyond administration and captures something about this kind of reshaping of the world, right? And so that's in that section, I offer an engagement with some of the sort of late career Meditations on Technology from Martin Heidegger, who has a lot to tell us, I think, about our orientation to technology, our orientation to the world, right? And how the technologies and systems that we build inframe us and sort of shape the way that we understand ourselves and each other and the world around us. And so I call it a kind of orientation, logistical orientation rather than a worldview, because worldview to me implies something that is either conscious or is ideological. Orientation is a general kind of positioning toward the world or a kind of openness to the world, right? And so what I'm trying to get at with that term logistical orientation is about the way that we view the world as what Heidegger called a kind of standing reserve of material to be marshaled according to our ends, whatever those ends may be.
To be organized, to be inventoried, to be circulated, all of those things that the list functions to do.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and that's, you know, to return to that kind of nest of concepts, right? I think that compression, calculation, circulation are really at the heart of this logistical orientation, right? Because it's about calculating how to circulate as much material, you know, as much material in as quickly a manner as possible. And that involves compression and it involves data calculations and organization of material in certain kinds of ways. And it cuts across this general kind of orientation to the world that will reduce things from the natural environment and people in the same kind of way, right? And that's what it sort of a population registry testifies to, I think, is this general kind of dehumanization, right? The treatment of a human being as a data point within right. this larger kind of project of reshaping the world in a certain image, and in that case, in the image of the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is the right time, too, to mention, you talk about this in the introduction and in the conclusion, you're not dismissing or degrading or condemning the list. The list is a tool or is a device, is a technology that can be used for various ends. Can you talk a little bit more about why that was an important point to make, that you're not condemning the list as foolish or as evil itself?
The easy argument to make would have been the one of condemnation, right? The one that comes down hard on listing techniques and views them as, you know, nothing more than this expression of evil, you know, of negativity in the world. But the history of listing that I explored, you know, through researching the project just wouldn't allow me to make that kind of claim. Like, it's just not the case. You know, lists have functioned in lots of different ways throughout history. And what they allow us to do is compare and contrast those larger kind of structures of knowledge and of activity, because the list operates at this kind of layer at which those larger concepts and techniques and actions, you know, upon which those are built, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what allowed me to make some of these comparisons that on the surface appear counterintuitive or quite you know, provocative. There's more to be said here than the list is either this or that, right? It is a lot of different things. And so this complicated history helps us to forge surprising connections that might expand the kind of horizon through which we you know, think about knowledge and history and poetics and these kinds of things. And so I tried to end the book, you know, after moving through some obviously fairly grim territory and thinking about, you know, modern fascism and statecraft and these kinds of oppressive uses of listing techniques in order to police subjects and to kind of build structures of knowledge that would exclude and would justify genocide. Right. I tried to kind of push beyond that and into a sort of exploration of how lists have been used to build other kinds of structures, other kinds of imaginative experiments with alternate orders and ordering techniques that might not be expressions of state power against individual subjects and oppressed groups, but might be about, you know, kind of exploding the boundaries and the horizons of the way that we think about the world in the hope that that might produce something new and more just. Yeah, something more just, I think, is probably the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And it's in the next chapter that you come to talk about uses of lists that haven't been dismissed or discussed as evil, but maybe as facile with the BuzzFeed listicle, though that's together with discussions of data analytics and ideas like big data that are in circulation today. Can you talk a little bit about the way that you bring your analysis of the logistical orientation into the late 20th century, where you see its expansion in all kinds of ways?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I thought was important, and what my research showed was important, once I started kind of mapping these different operations and following lists through these different historical moments, is that this kind of orientation to the world and viewing the world as a series of data points to be, you know, harvested and analyzed and kind of shuffled around, which I sort of show in the chapters on statecraft and the Nazi mm-hmm. census, that didn't just disappear, right? That didn't just go away. And so we see expressions of this, which are obviously not marshaled toward other kinds of ends, other kinds of projects, you know, not associated with fascism and camps and genocide, but are operating in the same kind of epistemological space, right? It's in the mm-hmm. same kind of mm-hmm. Way of knowing the world or way of orienting oneself to the world. And so digital computation is really built on this kind of logistical, what I call a kind of logistical orientation. BuzzFeed is an interesting kind of case study to me because through it we can read a lot of these different vectors, right? Not only is BuzzFeed have this kind of surface expression of list culture, right? Because it is the online platform that I think has done the most to kind of bring listing into the forefront of our minds when we think about digital culture. Mm-hmm. But it, but it is itself also this strange platform or institutional form that is kind of lists all the way down, right? So it's it has listicles as it's the content that it produces. It is a vertically integrated company, right? It houses all of its content production, data analysis. It has an in-house advertising team. It's like the classical Hollywood studio system, right? Where they, you know, Paramount owned all the cinemas and all the studios and all the cameras and all the equipment and had all the labor under contract. BuzzFeed is the same. It's exactly the same as a kind of spatial abstraction that is a sort of hierarchical list, right? It is a kind of collection, right? It kind of draws things mm-hmm. together in the way that mm-hmm. Lists do. And then, you know, I think crucially, the data operations of BuzzFeed give us an invitation to think about how analytics is this kind of nebulous and ever-changing way of organizing culture and knowledge and capital. Mm-hmm. BuzzFeed is different from social media platforms like Facebook or the other dominant platforms like Google, which are about aggregating. Facebook's about aggregating content created elsewhere into a nice, clean news feed for you to follow. Google is about aggregating like as much of the web as they can and then offering you a pathway through all of that data. BuzzFeed actually disaggregates content that it produces in-house and like sends it off into the web, right? Or and into mobile platform economies. And then what it does is it tracks, you know, where its content goes and how quickly it's shared, what its click-through rates are, mm-hmm. in order to glean in a different kind of way what people are doing and how they're doing it. And then they feed that into their in-house analytics system in order to figure out which content is hot, like right? Like what's going to sing to as many people as quickly as possible. And then that's the knowledge that they pitch to their ad clients, mm-hmm. who they create in-house curated advertisements for. And so it's a different kind of model. And I think it's essentially about time, right? Like it's essentially about mapping the circulation, right, of little morsels of culture, of memes and things like that in real time, right? So, mm-hmm. And then making calculations based off of that tracked activity in order to, you know, extract as much value from that knowledge as they can, right? So it's kind of creating this like monopoly of knowledge over cultural circulation that then it sells and tries to extract value from.
Mm-hmm. It's at this point in your book that you take a turn to discuss the ways in which listing is a cultural technique that can displace the processes and logic of logistical modernity with the poetics of listing. Can you talk about how that final chapter engages the argument and the history that you've laid out and how it comes to close the book and on what note?
So once I started thinking about BuzzFeed as about essentially about time in this kind of way, some surprising resonances with some of the literature that's been and some of the debates that have been arising in media archaeology helped me to think through some of these other aspects of list poetics that I had been playing with and trying to understand how they fit into the picture, right? So BuzzFeed is essentially about time, and I use BuzzFeed as a kind of paradigmatic example, but I think data analytics and digital culture broadly conceived are essentially about time, right? There, and that's why that's the utility of the term logistics to me, because logistics is all about just in time. And so this temporal aspect of contemporary computational or digital culture demands from us that we develop methods that are attentive to these temporal operations, right? And so media archaeology has been very much about trying to find tools through which to think about the way that these devices and networks process our sense of time, right? And the way that they kind of impose certain temporal experiences upon users and upon communities and things like that. And, you know, there's the general kind of mainstream argument that time is disappearing, or we're all experiencing a shared kind of real time together. But in actuality, I think there's never been a larger plethora of different times, right? Like computational time is essentially and fundamentally ontologically different from human time. And not every human, like there is no universal human time either, right? So someone working in an Amazon factory experiences time in a very different way than an academic does in the cultural milieu in which they find themselves, right? And so being attentive to these differences and slippages of time helps us to start thinking about data and the rhythms of information in a different kind of way. And so what Wolfgang Ernst, who's a very kind of provocative and influential media theorist associated with media archaeology, his work shows that, you know, actually what data operations and their emphasis on this kind of real-time tracking and aggregation are channeling rather ancient forms of organizing time, right, which are about aggregation and which are about, it's kind of, he calls it counting rather than recounting, right? So, you know, ancient storytelling techniques incorporate this kind of accumulation, this on and on and on and on, rather than the sort of if-then of a narrative, right? And so I started to think a little bit about like this, these poetics of time, and because Homer's catalog of ships is a list, right? You know, there are all these like ancient forms of conveying a story, of conveying information about the past that are not about a narrative structure, but are actually about this kind of aggregation. And so that helped me to kind of transition into this new register where we can also see, you know, a whole host of complicated list operations that are much more about poetics and are about, as I was mentioning earlier, I kind of jumped the gun, but allowed me to kind of end the book in thinking in this more generative mode, right? About how this kind of the and of infinity helps to kind of explore and maybe even explode the boundaries of the way that we are used to thinking about the world. And so the chapter's organized around some such explorations.
Maybe to close our discussion of the book, can you talk about the way that meditation comes to the ideas of heterotopia and wonder?
So those are ways that I tried to describe these operations of list poetics, right? So it's about trying to kind of collect the world. Like wonder is about, in the way I'm thinking it through in the chapter, is about kind of trying to collect the world, right? And not to impose a kind of causal relationship on events necessarily, simply to enumerate them, right? And so there's this quite rich tradition of literary and poetic thinking and writing and expression of just pulling the world in, right, and trying to sort of just pull as much of it in under this frame as possible, and to just kind of, you know, to inspire or kind of pull out a sense of wonder. And so Chris Marker is a filmmaker that I think is really very strongly operating in this register, right? So his films just resist our conventional way of understanding film and film narrative, right? They refuse and just will not abide by those structures. I tried to sort of suggest that this formal structure of that we see in so many lists, this on, is at play in even something like film. And it offers us a way to describe what artists like this are trying to explore, which is, a sense of wonder of the world and a sense of sort of probing the boundaries of sensory and cognitive experience, right? Heterotopia, yeah. So that this is another, I think, useful kind of heuristic or frame through which to think some other literary lists that are operating in the same, trying to do the same thing, right? Borges is the master of this. Mm-hmm. And what Borges is constantly inviting us to do is to like stand back from the conditions of knowing that we take for granted, to stand back and think about how we know what we know, when we know it, you know, in this historical moment. And so he crafts these lists that are intentionally impossible, right? Like the famous one that Foucault starts his book, The Order of Things, with, the analytical language of John Wilkins, which is about this Chinese encyclopedia that just has no, the classification system of the animals in the encyclopedia is just impossible, right? It's, I don't have it in front of me, but it's like, you know, the entries move from, you know, drawn with fine Hamel care brush to et cetera, to have just broken the pitcher of water, to, you know, from a long way off, look like flies, right? And they just like intentionally disrupts our expectations for what a list should look like, what a classification mm-hmm. should look like. And in that moment, he sort of, it's a moment of rupture, right? Where we like all of a sudden think about the conditions of possibility for knowing something that govern our everyday lives in the historical circumstances in which we find ourselves or into which we're kind of thrown. And so this was the way that Foucault read that list, and why he opened his book with that list is because that's what he was trying to do, right? Is to mm-hmm. create a long-term kind of intellectual project that was about exploring precisely those boundaries and those borders of thought in different historical moments and how they're drawn and how they're different, how they change. He wasn't so good on how they change, but he was really good on how they're sort of bordered. And so this project is obviously very inspired by that Foucauldian gesture, right? Because mm-hmm. this is, as he's sort of seeking the borders of knowledge, I'm suggesting that the borders of knowledge are drawn on material forms like lists. Not only lists, but certainly they're a very important important structure in that story.
Well, Liam, thanks for sharing some of your intellectual project with us. Again, we've been talking about list cultures, knowledge and poetics from Mesopotamia to BuzzFeed. Do you have anything that you're working on now? Maybe what's the next step for you in writing, in research? What could we be looking for in the future?
Well, I'm kind of in this moment now where one big project is now out there in the world, and it will go mm-hmm. and do whatever it does. And so I'm able to start to scratch some of the itches that that have been nagging at me as I've guided that ship to port. So actually, kind of interestingly, and I didn't plan it this way, but the subtitle of the book is Knowledge and Poetics, Mesopotamia to BuzzFeed. So there's basically two directions there, right? There's Mesopotamia and there's BuzzFeed. And actually, I'm working on those very projects. So one of them is thinking about the history of media theory and the work of Harold Innes, who sort of invented media theory in a certain kind of way by looking back to the origins of writing in Mesopotamia and the Fertile Crescent. So updating, rethinking some of Innes's work in light of contemporary developments around infrastructure, logistics, and some of the stuff that I talk about in the book. And that's related to the BuzzFeed stuff, which is that I'm really interested in kind of building that case study out mm-hmm. into something a little bit larger and understanding, you know, kind of digital media industries in the way that they are extracting value in different kinds of ways and are morphing nebulous kinds of structures that adapt and change according to new sort of innovations in data analytics and calculation and computation. So those are the two things on the go.
That's great. Again, Liam, thanks for taking the time to talk. I hope that everyone listening will check out the book. So again, Liam, just thanks for joining us on New Books in Intellectual History.
Thanks very much, Carl. It was a total pleasure.